We're talking about the state of mental health for youth here in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being with us. In any given year, about 1 out of 5 children will experience a mental disorder. And children's mental health in Wisconsin got a boost last month when Governor Evers signed legislation establishing a grant program for peer-to-peer suicide prevention programs. Wisconsin's teen suicide rate has been consistently higher than the national average for a decade. So how do you think Wisconsin could improve access to youth mental health services where you live? Where has your family run into barriers? How have you had to wait to meet providers? We're at 800-642-1234. Linda Hall directs the State Office of Children's Mental Health. She was appointed by Governor Evers and has been in the job since July last year. Linda, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you, Kate. Well, pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the new legislation that Governor Evers signed. One creates a pilot program. Another affects student IDs. And then there's a third piece addressing when students are placed in restraints or seclusion. So this new pilot program in Outagamie County, what is happening there?
Well, this is the legislation actually provides funding to enhance services that are already being given to children there through an existing child psychiatry consultation program. So it's going to allow more services to go to those individuals and to make them more targeted and to increase the referral and support to other services that they might need.
Oh, so you're building on a program that's already been established.
Yes. There is a framework there. And this kind of support to young people and help to navigate the mental health system is also being done in a number of schools throughout the state. In recent years, Wisconsin has become a leader in expanding school-based mental health, and we're doing that through a number of different supports. The legislature helped last year in terms of passing more money to allow these school community collaborations to get started, and there was also additional money given to provide more social workers and psychologists in schools.
Do all of the districts or all the counties do it all a little bit differently, or are you working from a central foundation in how you provide these services in terms of delivery?
Every community designs what makes sense for them. So they use the collaboration grant dollars to figure out what they need to do inside the school, whether that's training or events or support to a variety of folks in the school, not just teachers. It can be counselors. It can be other support people. And how they can engage providers and others in the community, the county mental health program, to come together to effectively provide support for students.
So they have some latitude within the county or within the district to be able to put those dollars where it's needed most as they see fit.
Yes, yes. And to use the resources they have, because as most people know, we have a shortage of mental health professionals really throughout the state. So they've got to figure out what they've got going in their county, where children can be referred to, and how we can make access to mental health treatment easier. The advantage of doing it at the school is that if a therapist is coming into the school, then the child doesn't have to be out of school as long, and parents don't have to leave work to transport that child.
Second law here signed, new student IDs must contain information about suicide prevention hotlines. Local and national hotlines have been often published in schools online. Why does the state also want these numbers in students' pockets?
Well, they want it to be really available quickly, that they can it's right and in hand. And there, in addition to phone lines, there is now a text line, which is really popular. And we want young people to have this information available. These suicide lines are really about preventing suicide, so they can help young people feel better. They can help them figure out what they should say to friends who are having some difficulties. Our office also this year created a mental health crisis card. And this really came as the result of a young person making this suggestion to us that people need a little card they can carry in their their wallet that says how to help them in the first 5 minutes they're having a crisis. And so they can, on this card, they can put down two or three things that helps them. Maybe they need quiet. Maybe they need, you know, to be given a hug. And then on the back of the card, they can write a person who is a good contact for them and a phone number or whatever other information. So that's been very popular. We're testing that in a few schools and getting lots of requests for it. And for those who want it digitally, they can take a photo of it and put it on their phone.
We are talking about efforts to improve children's mental health straight across the state this hour. Linda Hall is here. She's director of the state office overseeing that work. What questions do you have about children's mental health services here in Wisconsin? What do you want to know? How do you think our state could improve access to youth mental health services where you live? Where is your family running into barriers? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Linda, a third law signed by the governor last week addresses restraining or isolating students in the wake of concerns about how often this happens. What does the state know about the frequency of students being restrained or secluded?
Well, at this point in time, we don't know a lot, and that's part of what this law is going to allow. It's going to, schools have been keeping track, but they haven't been required to submit it to a central place. With this law in place, they will now be submitting that information to the Department of Public Instruction, so we'll have a better picture of what exactly is happening. But we know that seclusion and restraint happens when a child becomes unregulated, and that can be for a number of reasons. And what's the other good part of this law is that it requires the teachers and people who are involved in a child's individual education plan, if they have one of those, it requires them to get together, figure out what happened here, is there a way we could have prevented this situation, and how can we be better prepared? How can we make sure that this child has in place the things that they need to be exhibiting positive behaviors all day at school?
So this will be fresh data tracking that hasn't been tracked before?
As I said, it has been tracked at individual schools, but
hasn't been
assembled at the state level.
Let's look back at the year in review. The legislature is about to wrap up its regular session for the two-year session. Have lawmakers passed other measures this session that is really aimed at helping youth in their mental health issues?
Yes, I would say that the most important thing is that the legislature passed a law that allows school therapists to connect by phone with parents of students that they're treating. And that's really important because when we have family engagement, well, first of all, if the student is being cared for under Medicaid, it's required that the parents be involved. We always want parents involved in signing off on treatment. But if they're engaged with the student and with the therapist, we know that therapy is going to go farther, it's going to be more effective, and it's going to last longer. So this is a really important thing. We got in place in the last budget that consultation would be allowed, but we didn't have that parent piece in place. And that's critical because the therapist is at school and the parents are at work and they can't always find a time to meet together.
You find that there is not always that communication that is happening with the parents. They may not really understand what's going on with their student in school.
Right.
We are spending the hour with the head of Wisconsin's Youth Mental Health Office. Linda Hall is here. We're looking at all the variables on children's health and well-being here in Wisconsin. Are you a student or the parent of a student who struggles with mental health? Do you have enough services and training in your school? What do you think teachers or counselors should know? How well does your insurance cover mental health services for your child? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment with Linda Hall right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about children's mental health here in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to Wisconsin's Health Services Department estimates, our state needs 117 psychiatrists statewide to adequately address mental health services for patients of all ages. And now there's newly released 2018 data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showing suicide by children keeps going up year after year. So what gaps in children's mental health services do you see in your community? Is there a shortage of providers? Is it problems with transportation or the lack of affordable options? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Linda Hall directs the State Office of Children's Mental Health, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Let's go to Hope, who is joining us from Rice Lake this morning. Hi, Hope.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a comment in regards to the grants that have been allowed to the school districts in getting additional services within them. What I've seen in the rural areas is that there's no consistency, though. We've seen it get formulated to people that are within the district that they're trying to keep that person working there, but they don't necessarily have the credentials as far as like in social work or mental health crisis or like psychology. So I'm just wondering if there's going to be work done to kind of get at least some sort of regulation in there, because at some point it's kind of a disservice to the students when they're not utilizing it, I guess, and from my perspective, working in child protection, to the best that it could be.
So, Hope, thanks for that question. As we mentioned earlier, there is a shortage of mental health professionals throughout the state. And so schools are being creative about how they can bring supports into students. We hope that they are supervising people in a way that the children are getting good care. And we also know that the Department of Public Instruction, the Coalition to Expand School-Based Mental Health are organizations that are doing a lot of training in this area and helping people think about how do we innovatively get good services to children and be sure that they are also the people doing that are supervised appropriately. So it's a challenge that we're working on in it from a number of different ways.
Do you look at credentials, though, as, you know, people in districts are working with the students? How important is the credentialing?
Well, there are to be a therapist, you are credentialed and you're licensed, or you're in training and you're supervised by someone who is credentialed, licensed, and is experienced at supervising. There are other ways that people might be involved in the school and supporting children. But people who are doing therapy should be credentialed or supervised by somebody who is.
Let's look at some of your top priorities for continuing to improve youth mental health this year. One of the issues that you're seeing is bullying. What's going on there?
Well, we're seeing that bullying in Wisconsin is really above the national average. One of the measures that we look at indicates that we're the 11th worst in the nation. And we're talking about face-to-face or physical bullying, not cyberbullying. That's very concerning. So we are this year putting out monthly fact sheets. This is our fact sheet that actually is just coming out today, that it gives more data about the issue and also suggests things that we can do to make a difference. And when we're in our what we can do portion of our fact sheet, we are identifying what parents can do, what adults in the community can do, and what can be done legislatively or by governments. So we know that the federal government recommends that you have a definition of bullying and requirements to follow that. We don't have that in Wisconsin yet. We have a definition that's been created by the Department of Public Instruction, but it's not mandatory to put this in place. So what we're learning from what the research that we've done is that if you do some educating around this and supporting people, you can really make a difference. With children, we think it's important for parents to monitor what's going on. Parents should know whether their kids are having an issue. If they think their kids are having an issue, they should talk to the school. And we need schools to take a look at the issue and see what they can do to affect, in some ways, it's about affecting climate in the school. We want kids to feel like they belong at school. We want them to not be stressed out about being there because, bullying, whether you're the victim or the perpetrator, affects your performance in school. And we want kids to succeed there because we know that's important for their adult life.
Is it possible that the adults in the school don't realize what the climate is really like for those kids?
That's one possibility. That's one of the things with that's happening with the school mental health initiatives that are going on is that teachers are able to identify children. It's not always the children that seem to be acting out. Sometimes it's children who are withdrawn who need help. And so when we have more people in the school with this kind of mindset, identifying kids who might be at risk, then we can get supports to them and we can think about school climate. We talked a little earlier about some of the laws that have been passed in the last session. One is to provide some funding for peer-to-peer suicide prevention programs. And there's some really exciting ones going on. There are groups have started Hope Squad, which is an evidence-based program that's done in a number of states. And this is a peer-led program where the students get other students talking about this, talking about how to prevent suicide. And we know that where the students are involved in leading the school climate, that things move quickly. The stigma around mental health goes down and kids get better. So those are all really important things. That it's very exciting to see that kind of initiative is happening in a number of our schools.
We're exploring a variety of issues around youth mental health this hour with Linda Hall. She's director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health. Your questions, your situations are welcome. Are you a parent or grandparent? How do you feel about your child's mental health? What is the climate like at their school? Are they getting the support they need from family, friends, and their school? And what is your family trying to work on to help each other's mental health? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We talked briefly here that the state has a shortage of providers, and that is a real challenge to access, a challenge for families. How is your office trying to address a shortage of providers?
So we are taking what is called a collective impact approach to our work, and that's really about bringing a variety of stakeholders together to see how we can create systems change. So we convene regularly up to around 150 people who are from government, inside government, outside government. They are advocates for children and mental health. They are providers of those services. We bring them to the table to identify what the problems are. And we have a council, an open council of people. We invite people to contact us and join our council. And then we have work groups. We have a work group specifically working on access that is coming up with a number of ways to try to address this issue. We're looking at how can we influence the work shortage issue itself, but how can we make the existing system easier to navigate? Because one group of people we bring to the table are people with lived experience in navigating the system, either for themselves or for their children. And they tell us it's really hard to navigate the system. It's hard to get the information you want. If you have difficulty, you might be able to find a therapist, but it might not be a therapist who really connects with your child or has the experience to work on the issues that your child has. So we're trying to help people figure out how to navigate the system and how to bring down some of the hurdles in getting through the system.
Are other states having more successes recruiting mental health providers after graduation or, getting at them as they do their training?
Well, I think the mental health professional shortage is the same across the country. Maybe not that it may exist at different levels, but everyone is having an issue with that. We are looking at ways to influence the number of people coming into the mental health professions, and how can we reduce some of the barriers to that? How can we support them to get through the academic training, and then to get through the practice hours that they have to have before licensure. So we're working on the shortage from that angle, too.
Let's take another call. Mary is with us from Ashland. Good morning, Mary.
Hi. I have a comment about a little story that a bus driver told me about a young child who was screaming on the bus, and he felt that it was, this child had a real, anxiety issue that she could not express well. And I want to just comment that there's a really important link between healthy food and a young child's ability to deal with anxiety. You know, it's some children do have, they do have maybe a physiological problem, but I think diet should really be looked at.
Mary, we're short here on time, but I just want you to be able to respond there to Mary saying your basic needs, such as your food and diet, really important.
Those are very important, and we know that all of those basic needs have an effect on children's well-being. And our office is really concerned about overall well-being, because that's important for mental health well-being.
We're exploring all facets of children's mental health this hour, the challenges, the legislative efforts with Linda Hall. She's director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health. Gathering your questions, your insights as well, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Linda Hall and a look at kids' lived experiences after this news update on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Former Vice President Biden's campaign is chalking up at least four more wins in the race for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. Biden won contests in Michigan, Missouri, Mississippi, and Idaho yesterday. The results from Washington State and North Dakota are still unofficial. NPR's Scott Detrow says Biden's latest wins follow his strong showing 1 week ago on Super Tuesday.
It makes it really, really hard for Bernie Sanders to get back in this race at this point in time, having lost Michigan to Joe Biden. Statistically, there's still a way if there's a drastic shift in the race, but this is a major blow to a campaign that coming out of Nevada seemed to be in the driver's seat.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has signed a decree that calls for the release of about 1,500 Taliban prisoners. NPR's Dia Hadid says it's part of an agreement signed last month between the Taliban and the U.S.
The decree says another 3,500 will be freed when negotiations begin between the government and insurgents. A U.S. Taliban deal signed last month calls for the Afghan government to release 5,000 insurgents from its prisons as a goodwill measure to start peace talks. It's unclear if the Taliban will accept this decree as it stands.
That deal also calls for the U.S. military to reduce its forces in Afghanistan from roughly 13,000 to 8,600. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 6:31. I'm Keely Boltina. Governor Tony Evers is calling for increased funding to help communities reduce the risk of flooding. As Hope Kerwin reports, the governor visited flood-prone communities in western Wisconsin yesterday to talk about the bills.
Evers recommended six new bills that would increase grant funding for local governments to repair flood damage and work on mitigation. The governor highlighted the legislation during a roundtable event to hear from local officials and residents who have been impacted by flash flooding. Barb Talk is a chairperson for the town of Arcadia. She says her community would like to make roads and bridges more resilient to flooding, but their budget is simply too small.
Everything comes down to money. It's a money-related issue. And we're trying to do our best as far as working with the resources we have, but there's no perfect solution.
But lawmakers in the assembly may not consider the bills. Speaker Robin Voss issued a statement Tuesday saying the assembly was done with this year's session. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Election officials in Wisconsin are making contingency plans for what they'll do if polling places are closed down due to concerns about the novel coronavirus. They're meeting ahead of the April 7th presidential primary. Megan Wolf is the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. She says she worries about COVID-19 are complicating the job of local election clerks. Wolf says plans for what happens if a polling place can't operate due to a flood or a fire could also apply to this situation.
That planning that the clerks have been doing and that exercising of their plans over the last couple of years are very applicable to a health concern as well.
Wolf also says Wisconsin has seen absentee voting increase in recent years, and it's possible coronavirus fears will further drive that number up. The graduation rate for Wisconsin high schools increased in 2019. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction says 9 out of 10 students in the class of 2019 completed high school within 4 years. The increase is a continuation of an upward trend. The Education Department reported yesterday the state's graduation rate has increased 1.6% over the past 5 years. There were also improvements among smaller subgroups of students. Those include Black people, Hispanic people, and people learning how to speak English. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. You can get more Wisconsin news anytime. Just visit WPR.org.
You're with us for the morning show as we look at the health and well-being of children in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Health officials say a child's development and growth is influenced by their surroundings. A lack of housing, a lack of food, health care may all contribute to anxiety. And adolescent depression can present with irritability, rage, anger, instead of just sadness. What questions do you have about children's mental health services in Wisconsin? What do you want to know? How do you think Wisconsin could improve access to youth mental health services where you live? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Linda Hall heads up the State Office of Children's Mental Health, and she's our guide this hour. Linda, let's follow up, look a little bit closer at anxiety. What are you seeing there in the communities in Wisconsin?
So, you know, Kate, we do an annual report, and our recent annual report shows that anxiety is increasing again among our young people, as is depression and major issues, major episodes of depression. We have other data that show us that 40% of children are feeling sad or hopeless at points during the last 12 months. So these are really concerning factors, and we know that some of those factors you just mentioned, housing insecurity, food insecurity, other kinds of stress that their families have are playing into this. So some of the experts I've talked to have said that they think that's what's the real increase in anxiety is because families are so stressed in their lives. So we need to figure out how we support families. We want them to be resilient, have them have the skills to work with their kids on positive behaviors and to be resilient themselves. We're seeing this manifested at school. The teachers that we talk to tell us that they're really surprised and actually overwhelmed by the levels of stress that they see kids bringing to school. And so they have to deal with that in the classroom. And that's what part of why we want to emphasize bringing mental health into the school, because when we can help that teacher work successfully with one child, that teacher is going to learn how to do more with other kids in the classroom.
There's been this push to expand training of trauma-informed care, where you approach someone from the perspective of what happened, what happened to you, rather than what's wrong with you. Is more training still needed in this area?
We have been very strong advocates for trauma-informed care. Our office in the previous years, that was the primary focus, was trauma-informed care. A lot of training has happened. Our office actually just put on a training for people working in the field to deal with their secondary or vicarious trauma. We had over 1,000 people sign up for that training, and we were able to have the training broadcast to 30 locations around the state, where after a training session, a panel of experts talked about it, we had facilitated discussion in those areas. So I would say there has been a lot of training out there. There's a lot of basic training out there, but there's more to be done. And it's a constant effort to keep training people and training new people who come into the field. Mm-hmm. So the Department of Health Services is also looking at this, how to disseminate more training, have the kinds of training that people now need if it goes beyond basic training, and how to get that out to everywhere in the state.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Department of Health Services. How is your communication between the various departments that are working on each of these different issues around children's mental health and well-being?
Well, I mentioned our Collective Impact Council. We have representatives from the four departments that are involved in children and families' lives. So, and we're actually statutorily required to work with these folks and try to align efforts that will improve children's mental health. So the departments are the Department of Health Services, the Department of Children and Families, of course, the Department of Public Instruction, and the Department of Corrections. So we have really good relationships with those people. We're in contact with them all the time. Our data, some of it comes from them. And we are right now in a process this year of working to do an environmental scan of what all these departments are doing, and to then get that down on paper and take a look at it and say, well, what are the different efforts that people are up to? Can we align them a little bit more so that we can have a bigger impact in improving children's mental health?
Align and see where the crossover is.
Right.
Maybe even see redundancies.
Yeah. This is actually an effort that we went through previously, and once that original list was made, people came to our impact table and started realizing that their counterparts in another department were doing something kind of similar. They decided to start sharing resources. They also started supporting each other in terms of grants they were applying for. So we've seen improvement with this kind of effort before. We're looking to build on what we did before and take that even farther. And in terms of where we want people to align, we have set out an agenda for ourselves this year that really looks at the lifespan of a child and what are some key points along the way that we think we could affect if we were all kind of putting our shoulders to the plow in the same kind of way.
We're talking with Linda Hall, the director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health, looking at all facets of mental health and our kids this hour. With you as well, what is your experience with children and mental health in your community? How well does your insurance cover youth mental services? Have you faced issues with coverage or with copays or with making quick appointments? How could your insurance be better? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Karen from Minnesota called, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to say Karen's a grandparent of 11 young children and sees that nutrition nowadays is just lacking. That is the root of the problem. The amount of sugar kids have is criminal, Karen says, and is very concerned about what children are eating all through the day.
Well, I would say, you know, that does take us back to the physical well-being of children, which is important for their mental health. And some of the behaviors that children exhibit are really their ways of telling us that there's something not going right for them. It can be nutrition. It can be the food that's available to them. We know that there are a lot of efforts to try to improve that in schools and that. So we're certainly supportive of those. But, yeah, we need to look at the whole picture.
We had Attorney General Josh Call on our program recently looking at a lot of issues, and we briefly touched on emergency detentions. And he raised concerns about officers driving across the state to reach the state's Winnebago Hospital in Oshkosh.
The process is also cumbersome because it involves a medical clearance at a local hospital before somebody's transported to Winnebago County. It's bad for police because it means they're spending a lot of time in that process, and it's bad for people going through a mental health crisis, because when we should be trying to get them access to treatment, they're instead going through this lengthy process.
Linda, how often are children being admitted to the state's Winnebago Hospital?
Well, there are children being admitted there. There have been in recent years. They've been at capacity, so we know that there are issues around that. In our offices, we look for ways to increase children's access to mental health. We're really looking for what are the community solutions we can employ that will keep us from having to send kids off to the hospital. Because what Attorney General Call describes is true. It's anxiety producing. It can be trauma inducing for the child. You know, if they're experiencing a crisis and then they have this trauma of being put in the back of a squad car, maybe shackled. It's not good. We want to avoid that from happening. So we are looking at ways to increase crisis responses. There will be, in the upcoming year, there will be new crisis stabilization centers that have been supported through funding by the legislature. So we're looking forward to those coming online. But we also know that this educating of educators, childcare educators, and parents about the signs of what kids are giving us are really important. So kids give us signs by their behavior. That's how they express their behavior, their mental health, is through their behaviors rather than words. If we can understand those signs earlier and get support to people, we think we can avoid a lot of those emergency detentions. And sometimes that's an issue of a parent or a peer helping the parent understand how to respond and giving them a few more ideas about how to do it positively so you can stop that kind of downward spiral that can happen when a child is in crisis.
What are these crisis stabilization centers? Can you tell us about them?
So there will be two or three new centers of up to 8 beds each that will be available for children who are having a mental health crisis. So they will go through the county crisis worker will decide that they need to go into one of these places. They'll have a short stay there where a plan will be made to bring them back home as quickly as possible and with wrapping around the kind of services that they need to keep them safely at home and to support their parents. Because sometimes what's needed is that parents and kids need a break. And then they can, with, you know, that break and then some supports, they can come back and they can move on from there very effectively without having to have hospitalizations.
So it's kind of like a preventative or intermediary approach in order to prevent those hospital stays or even perhaps going straight across the state to Winnebago Hospital.
Exactly.
We are looking at all the issues around children's mental health this hour with Linda Hall. She's director of the state office overseeing that work. Your questions straight through the hour. What gaps in children's mental health services do you see in your community? Is there a shortage of providers? Have you faced issues with insurance coverage? What is your experience with copays or with making quick appointments? Is your child worried about COVID-19? How are you talking with them about their fears? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We have Linda Hall through the hour. There's still time for your questions. We'll be back in just a moment. More conversation right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We have the head of Wisconsin's Youth Mental Health Office, Linda Hall, is here with us for a look this hour at how the state is working to help more children develop those flourishing behaviors like resiliency, like curiosity. And we've been touching on efforts to address provider shortages and school-based care and hospitalizations. With your thoughts, still time for you, 800-642-1234. Let's take another call now. Emma is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Emma.
Hi. I wanted to ask about bringing outside services into the schools. I'm a recent school counseling graduate, and I've worked in a couple of districts, and as like school counselors, we have caseloads of 200-300 students. So a lot of things that you're talking about are things that we're trying to tackle every day and help students with, but it's just impossible with the caseload. So I've seen a lot of school districts like West Dallas has outside counselors come in during the day. So students that don't have the ability to go out with their parents and access these services can get them right in the school during the school day.
Emma, thank you so much for that. How about that access right in the school?
That is just terrific. And we're seeing an increasing number of schools bring therapists into their school buildings to do that therapy right at school. Because as Emma says, the school counselors, the school social workers are really overwhelmed. We have the ratio of school counselors to students in Wisconsin is far below what the national standard recommends. So they just don't have time to do that kind of work that a therapist coming in from the outside with that one job is able to do. We also know that school psychologists are really, their time is totally taken up in doing assessments and other kind of testing things. So they're not really not available for it either. That's why bringing therapists in is important. What we need to do is figure out how to make that financially sustainable, because the majority of students being identified as needing some therapy are on Badger Care or Medicaid, and that program only pays a portion of the cost to bring the therapist into the school. But where it's happening, it's working pretty well. We know that we are reaching more students, but we're certainly not reaching everybody who needs help.
Let's bring in Jimmy now in Racine. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My son was autistic and graduated from high school in 2016. And that was an incredible experience that we had to deal with. It was a lot of hands-on as a parent and with his brothers, helping him cope with the general population of the school and what have you. I guess the best advice I can give people is parental involvement is a must. It is so crucial on helping your child navigate the public school system in regards to the general population, through classes, between classes. I mean, it's a lot of work on both parts, from the teacher and the parents, as well as his brothers. The other thing is IEP. IEP is a very helpful tool to get everybody in the team on board and all going on the same sheet of music. Anytime you have any issues as a parent, a lot of parents don't even realize that you can schedule an IEP yourself as a parent as well, to address any situations that you feel that you need to be taken care of, especially when it comes to child safety and things like that.
Jimmy, and we're short on time. Thank you so much for sharing your story. He mentioned their IEP, the Individual Education Plan.
Right. Jimmy, your son is very lucky to have you as an advocate. It sounds like you've hit all the right buttons, and you are absolutely right. We need to have parents involved. It takes a lot of parent time to make this work successfully for a student. And we at the Office of Children's Mental Health are really looking for people like you who have that experience to come and be our advisors and help us even more figure out what parts of state government and legislation we should be paying attention to in order to make your job as a parent easier and your son's success at school more reachable.
And in the last 10 seconds or so, I know you wanted to mention screen time. What are you seeing there?
So we are issuing monthly fact sheets. We did one on healthy use of screen time. What we're seeing, that the average student is spending more than 7 hours on a screens during the day, and that's exclusive of their schoolwork. And we know that there is a connection between increased screen time and increased anxiety and depression. We don't see a causal relationship, but there is a relationship there. And we want kids to be off their screens, getting connected, because that social connectedness is important for their learning and their success.
Linda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Linda Hall is director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about Freemasons in northern Wisconsin.
There are several regional lodges of Freemasons in Wisconsin's North Woods, but the network has always had an air of mystery. That got us wondering about the history of these places. What is the role of a Masonic temple in a community? Mackenzie Martin headed to the Rhinelander Masonic Temple to find out as part of WXPR's Curious North series.
There's a certain kind of look that the most famous Masonic temples have. Big white columns, stained glass windows. Though smaller than some, the Masonic Temple in Rhinelander has been around since 1930 and fits right in. Once you're inside, the most interesting room is arguably the lodge room, where ceremonies take place.
Are you ready to see the coolest room in Rhinelander?
Well, you stay here, I'll turn the lights on first.
The high ceilings of the lodge room make it feel bigger than it already is. Elevated in the back of the room are three chairs beneath an illuminated letter G. Tony Jones is the one leading a tour of the Rhinelander Masonic Temple today, because he's currently in charge of it. This is his official title.
I am the Worshipful Master.
He points out one of the most famous symbols to me, the square and compasses with the letter G.
The compasses teach us to circumscribe our behavior and keep us within due bounds of all mankind. And the G represents geometry, but in a bigger sense, it represents God.
Jones acknowledges that there is still a certain air of mystery about the Freemasons, But he says the Masons are mostly just a group of men who support one another as they try to be better versions of themselves. He says that the Rhinelander Masonic Temple is not a mysterious place.
You know, you don't open up a door and all of a sudden there's a half a dozen rolls from the library to Alexandretta.
As is the case for many small towns, the Masons were instrumental in building Rhinelander in the early days. In 1930, the town of Rhinelander raised $50,000 to build the Masonic Temple.
Which is a tremendous amount of money for a town this size going through a depression.
They're also the oldest civic group, and they laid the cornerstone for the library and the courthouse. Whole rooms upstairs are full of historical portraits of Rhinelander's early Masons.
You start seeing some of the street names when you start looking at the roles of members here, of what they did, the school board, the telephone company. You know, it's almost limitless what these men came up here to do. And then when you look at all these pictures, they came up here by wagon train or on foot, and they built something out of the woods.
Stories like this are why some people think the Freemasons run the world. And in a way, they kind of have. Many United States presidents were Masons, and Jones admits that when he travels, he has taken advantage of the vast network and been welcomed into many lodges. He says the way Masons identify each other is something he likes to keep secret. Today, the Rhinelander Masons are still a men's-only lodge, but otherwise they're open to new members as long as they believe in some form of a higher power.
The three major tenets of Freemasonry are friendship, morality, and brotherly love. Part of being a Freemason is the ability to give back to your community.
Giving back to the community is a huge part of what their Masonic Lodge is trying to do now. But it didn't used to be like that. It all changed about 2 years ago, prompted by a decision from Wisconsin's Grand Lodge.
The most worshipful Grand Master of the state of Wisconsin sent a note, an edict out to all the lodges saying it's time to become family friendly again. And we took that to heart and said it's time to open our doors.
So they decided to bring the Masonic Temple back to the old days of being a community building. They even host weddings and other parties now. And Jones feels like they're now using the building for the purpose it was meant to be used for. Meanwhile, across the country, many Masonic lodges have had to downsize and move out of their temples because there are less Masons than there used to be. So in the end, what purpose do Masonic temples serve in the community? It depends on the community. No matter what Masonic temple you're in, though, there's likely a lot of history and a few secrets.
WXPR's Mackenzie Martin brought us that story as part of their Curious North series. It's a lot like WPR's Wisconsin Project, where we answer audience questions in Wisconsin Life segments. To submit your question, go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, we look at how the airline industry is dealing with the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's trying to keep air travelers safe. We have a transportation analyst with us explaining what airliners are dealing with and what travelers need to know. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.